Welcome to the latest episode of The Grower and The Economist. I'm Michelle Klieger, The Economist.
And I'm Peter Kanjoyan, The Grower.
Each week, we team up to tackle the biggest challenges facing small and medium-sized growers. We're one part grower and one part economist, just like your business. This week on The Grower and The Economist, the conversation between Peter and I is a little different than normal. We both approach growing and farm businesses from a different perspective. He's the grower, and I'm the economist. The nice thing about our relationship is that we often get to learn from each other. As you'll tell, Peter's had some burning questions about the economy, inflation, and supply chain disruptions. So, for the next half an hour, Peter quizzed me on these developments, and then we bring it back to the growers and how it's going to impact your next season. Enjoy the episode, and thanks for listening.
So we've spent time on the podcast in the last, over the whole three-year period. We've talked about supply chains, Michelle, and more recently, costs, rising costs. We use fertilizer as an example. So help me understand the equation, the separate components, how, all right, rising costs, all of rising cost is not inflation, but inflation is a part of it. So I think what I'm asking 3 years into our relationship in this podcast, try and break down the complexity. We've been talking about simple math, addition and subtraction and multiplication. This is now approaching a little more of a algebra 2, pre-calculus. Explain to me that factor of inflation while it's dominating the news today with midterm elections, what role that plays and how it relates to rising costs and supply chain.
So the technical definition of inflation is higher prices, and generally it is too much money chasing too few goods. Most of the time we think about higher inflation when there's more money available, right? And so when there is a lot of money supply, when there's a lot of credit, right? If businesses can easily borrow money and they can have that access to credit and they're going to invest in expanding their buildings, right? There's a lot of money competing for concrete or construction laborers. And so that drives the price of it up. That's the more traditional way of looking at it. One of the other things that answers your supply chain disruption point is that there's no goods, right? Maybe the money, which it didn't, but let's say the money stayed constant. Everybody had the same amount of money they had 3 years ago. With supply chain disruptions, right, with factories being shut down, with there not being enough drivers to truck materials different places, we're not bringing as many goods to market. And so now there's not necessarily more money chasing the same number of goods. There's the same amount of money chasing fewer goods. And so the people that want them are going to be the people that are willing to pay more, which drives prices up. And so we're seeing it on both sides right now. You're definitely seeing more money supply, right? There were trillions of dollars between President Trump and President Biden spent on pushing money into the economy. And whether it was, keeping businesses afloat or food, access to food or waiving rents, all of those things increased the amount of money available. So people had more money to buy goods and services. On the other side of it, things were shut down. And whether it's power, at this time last year, you had coal mines in China shut down. That's less energy coming to the market. You had COVID restrictions preventing the transport. You had reduced wind renewable power in Europe. So then you had Russia entering Ukraine. And so you lost Russia's energy supply. And then with drought this summer, hydroelectric dams are a huge source of renewable energy. So you've taken energy and made it a really scarce resource. And so now people that are willing to pay the most for it get to use it. And that means higher transportation costs. It means higher electricity costs. It means higher fertilizer costs or less fertilizer because you can't make enough money selling fertilizer and you're better off using the limited energy and putting it in aluminum because you can make more money doing that.
So tell me if I'm hearing you accurately. On one hand, on one side, we have basic supply and demand, and that can affect price increases. And that's where you and I have been. That sandbox is the one we've been playing in. Now, all of a sudden, we have inflation entering the equation as another factor that is having a negative effect. If I'm hearing you correctly, it's been partly a result of trying to fuel the economy with inputs, construction, infrastructure, all of those projects. And now that just by nature is going to trigger some inflation or spike some inflation. And then combined with the supply and demand, now we've got a perfect storm kind of thing.
Kind of. I mean, the construction sort of was an example. So the reason when the Fed, while trying to, or all federal reserves around the world, trying to manage inflation, raise interest rates. So by raising interest rates, it's more expensive to borrow money, which means people have less access to money, which means there's less money to purchase goods. And then the other way, which is not talked about, and I don't always know why, but the other way to reduce the money supply is to raise taxes. If you had everybody pay more in taxes, they would have less money to spend on goods and services. That reduces the money supply available and pulls down inflation. And so you see that when there is a recession, we lower interest rates because we want people to spend more money to keep the purchasing going. And when we talk about stimulating the economy, that's when we start talking about tax cuts. Well, if people are giving less money to the government, they have more money to buy from other businesses. And so those stimulate the economy. And so that's what's happening right now is there's too much money chasing too few goods. And so the government is trying to reduce money supply by raising interest rates.
So is there a direct correlation between a humming economy and inflation rising?
You want some level of inflation. The Fed's goal is to keep unemployment low and to keep inflation at roughly 2% per year. So inflation itself, like at 2%, is not bad. It's a sign of a healthy economy, or it's what we've decided is a healthy economy. Dangerous inflation is double digit or hyperinflation, where you lose credibility in the money or you can't afford anything, period. And it sort of spirals because as you expect prices to go up, people start hoarding. And so they purchase more, which creates a spiral. And that's why the Federal Reserve right now would rather push us into a recession and raise rates too quickly than let people fear that the government is going to let hyperinflation happen and let the economy spiral out of control.
Okay, a lesser of two evils kind of thing.
So that's where the Federal Reserve is, that it's the lesser of two evils to have a mild recession than leave inflation unchecked. And that's why Paul Volcker had to come in and say, I'm raising interest rates to 20%, we're going to break this cycle. The other side, which is more dangerous to economies, is deflation. So the reason that inflation at a low percentage is okay is you took out a mortgage on your home, and let's say it was 5%. You expect over the next 30 years, when you purchased your home, right? So you're probably younger when you purchase your home, you expect that your income is going to increase over time and your mortgage is fixed. So throughout your life, your mortgage is going to get relatively cheaper, right? As the cost of everything goes up, your mortgage payment stays the same. The cost of your house goes up over the time. The same thing happens for the government. The government borrows money And as the money gets worth less, they actually pay back less than the original value. Okay. So on the other side, you have deflation, which is when you expect things to be worth less in the future than today. That would mean that you wouldn't purchase anything today and you'd wait to buy it. And so if nobody's spending money today, everything comes to a halt. If your house is going to be worth less in the future, like people stop making payments because, and so like deflation is so much worse. It really breaks systems, and mild inflation is what we want. And high inflation is when there's runs on money and, you know, crazy prices and people storing money in sugar because it holds its value better than the currency.
So tell us where inflation is today, what we're expecting as we embark on 2023 production plans on a farm and in a greenhouse. Let's talk a little bit about what our growers, our listeners might be seeing on the horizon, Michelle, with your perspective.
Well, I mean, there is still inflation, right? It is still higher than we're used to. And I think that it's higher than we're used to is a really important caveat. I am 36 still, and in my lifetime, I have never really experienced inflation above, 5%, 8%? I mean, and in the last decade, since 2008, so 15 years, we've had relatively almost 0% interest. So like the goal is to have an GDP growth and inflation at 2% a year. And for most of my adult life, it's been well below that target. So now being at that target or above is jarring. And so to say that we're at the highest rates of inflation in 40 years, there's some recency bias in how low it is. So I would first argue that I do not think that we are in a cycle of hyperinflation where all of our money is going to be worthless next year. You know, I do think that the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates to try to keep inflation under control. Agriculture is very export dependent. And so especially for your big commodities that we export a lot of, when the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, the dollar gets stronger to more currencies. So I talked online last week about how I was reading a Wall Street Journal article, and it's read in euros. The euro is now worth less than the dollar. 97 cents buys you 1 euro. And so like most of the time, the dollar is weaker than the euro. What that means is it's harder for other people to buy our goods. Right? Their money is worth less relative to ours. And so buying U.S. products is more expensive. It also means that importing is cheaper. Our U.S. dollars buy more goods and services abroad. So my first thought was that conventional, traditional agriculture, your row crops, your, you know, beef, pork, chicken that we export a lot of, they're going to run into challenges. They're not going to be able to export as much of those products because they're more expensive. But on the greenhouse side or the vegetable side, if you're competing with greenhouse operations in Canada or Mexico, those products just got cheaper, or they could get cheaper. So that does put pressure on our small growers. So that, I think, is one thing on like the pricing side that will be relevant. I think that goods, again, are higher than they were before the pandemic. I don't know that they're ever going to go back down. But now that you're in your second or maybe third season, depending on which prices we're talking about, I'm guessing a lot of people have built in higher prices now and higher labor prices. That as long as they don't keep increasing by 10%, like, can you adjust the budget you used this year and make it work next year too? I don't know. I think people get comfortable very quickly with change.
Well, I'm going to repeat a theme that we've been, the flag we've been carrying ever since we had Dr. Bridget Behe on, in terms of pricing at the small farm level, and that is that it's our game to lose. And it seems that the comments you're making are still aligned with that, that regardless of the reasons behind costs rising, whether it's all inflation, part supply chain, it's got to be passed along. We're not nonprofits. We have to be able to raise prices. So yeah, that part's all cool. I want to go back and reference you being 36, I'm 68, Michelle, and I feel that over my lifetime, my adult lifetime, I'm witnessing, tell me if I'm right or wrong here, I'm witnessing where when I was your age or maybe even younger, you know, and there was periods in the U.S. economy of runaway inflation, I feel like over my lifetime, as economists, as government, we've learned how to anticipate it and perhaps ward it off at the pass a little bit, so that we're at a point where you now, your generation, can say, well, I've never seen what you're talking about. And I'm sure every now and then you can have a catastrophic storm, but am I right? Are we learning more as a society in terms of how to regulate this machine?
I would say yes, right? I think that we learn a lot from past experiences. I think that just a couple of weeks ago, Ben Bernanke won the Nobel Prize in Economics for his research on bank runs. And that was what his research was on in grad school and as a professor. And so that research on how bank runs and money and government policy, Federal Reserve interest rates, impacted how severe the Great Depression was, he was kind of the perfect person to be in charge of the Federal Reserve during the Great Recession, because he built on his research. Generally, during the Great Depression, there were bank runs and everybody wanted their money, and there was nobody to give money and encourage spending and to let go. And so first, as Federal Reserve chair, he lowered interest rates to zero. But then he found other ways to put more money into the economy and keep it going, reducing the impact of the Great Recession. And I'm not saying that it wasn't bad for most people, but like, was it less bad? Hopefully. Could we learn from that? Hopefully. But on the other side, like, I think there's a limit to how much people are willing to understand and learn from history, and like, what our experiences are really important. I mean, we didn't know during the pandemic in 1918, right? The great influenza that happened at the end of World War I. We didn't have germ theory. We didn't understand how viruses spread. We knew that reducing public meetings and wearing masks were helpful. We didn't know why. People fought it then and they fought it now. Our understanding of virology and stuff like that has improved, but does that mean we're going to prevent the next pandemic? Probably not. And will it come from somewhere else? Probably. So I kind of feel that way about the finances as well, right? The global economy. We understand more. We could make better decisions. Are people always going to listen? No. And does our world evolve where there's new challenges? We didn't have nearly as much global travel that we had now. I don't think we can avoid recession, but I think that we can hopefully manage it better if we're willing to.
Yeah. I think perhaps the last point on this, and nice job bringing in the Great Depression. So if on a continuum over time, my parents lived through and experienced the Great Depression, I didn't. Now your generation and mine kind of straddled at the same time the Great Recession. So we're able to avoid another Great Depression. So we went from depression to recession. So what's going to be the next one that kind of catches us off guard? Let's say we learned about the Great Recession. We learned enough about how to manage inflation and interest rates and whatnot. What would be next? A mild recession? And does that mean each time we just cry a little louder over less and less pain?
Maybe. So not to get too technical, right? So a depression is a longer recession or a deeper recession. So you're right on the milder. Or the difference, I think, that you have to add in 2008 was there was a recession, but it was caused by a financial crisis. And a financial crisis is, in lay terms, when something is broken in the banking system. So the mortgage markets broke, which caused a recession, right? And so like the Asian financial crisis in the 90s was the banking system in Asia broke and it spread to other parts of the world and that caused a recession. So you can have a financial crisis without a recession and you can have a recession without a financial crisis, but the fact that they went together made everything more intense. And so right now, ideally, there's not really a financial crisis happening. There's inflation. And so the Federal Reserve is going to raise money to reduce spending. And when you reduce spending, it can cause a recession.
Can we foresee the next banking crisis, or are we preparing ourselves to foresee the next XYZ crisis that today we might not even be able to identify?
So sometimes after the Great Depression, right, you had banking regulations that prevented banks from having savings accounts and having investments accounts. And then under President Clinton, we got rid of that, right? Glass-Steagall, we got rid of, and we allowed banks to do both again. So like there was this reversion to then banks being riskier, even though they held savings accounts, which was a problem for average people. So like sometimes there are measures that are put in place. And as we've mentioned, over time, when it wasn't the people that live through it and understand why those rules are in place, they start to say, well, do we need that anymore? Like, I'd actually like to earn more money on my savings account. So maybe we should get rid of this rule so I can earn more money on my savings account. And like, we forget why. I also think that the world is evolving very quickly. And so like there are new, you know, financial structures. There are new challenges. And with globalization, like it's just faster.
Yeah.
And so I think that some we probably can't see and some we don't want to see, right? Like everybody loves this idea of free money. And I think the term is overused a lot, but there's a term black swan. And the story is that, you know, somebody thought that all swans were white because they had never seen a black swan. And so you just assumed that all swans were white. And then one day you saw this black swan and the whole world changed. The idea is that it is something you cannot predict. And so saying that the global pandemic was a black swan to me feels not really accurate, because while it hadn't happened in a long time, could a cruise company assume that it's possible that there would be a, you know, pandemic that would shut down cruises or shut down schools? Like, it has happened before. So I think that we like to live within our narrow, this is what's possible and this is what I'm comfortable with, and that's too scary, so I'm going to ignore it. And we leave more things to chance than necessary. But the other side is, like, should a cruise line have to carry millions of dollars of insurance for a pandemic that happens once every 100 years? Like, maybe not.
So you've helped me understand a little more about economics than at the end of this conversation than when I came in. Thank you for that. And I think I'll try to relate it, bring it back down to crop production and our growers and listeners, and kind of tie it together and say, as much as we think we understand about insect and disease control and how we can prevent certain insect outbreaks and disease infestations, there's always that new disease, that new type of white fly, that new strain that's on the horizon, and we never know when it's coming and how it's coming. And we just need to be able to go with the flow and react to it. So,
yeah. And I think that even taking it one step farther, we've talked a ton about smaller companies being able to pivot. Like, that's the advantage. If the price of fertilizer had never gotten to where it was, or if fertilizer had flown from Russia like it has since 1989, companies felt safe purchasing on a big contract. And so maybe they were locked into this current system, and small growers are less baked into the bigger system. So when the whole system shakes, they are harmed less, or they have the ability to pivot more. And I think that that's something that's been really interesting, whether it's the pandemic or supply chain disruptions or inflation, is listening to how much small growers have been able to pivot. And I actually visited two farms this week, and really both of them are still using this time to experiment. Like, they live in a period where there has been so much change in the last 3 years that they're willing to try lots of new things still. Like, we haven't, if we've been in a paradigm shift where everything's still kind of fluid, these small growers are still living in that space. And then eventually we're going to settle into a new normal. They're not there yet. And like, whether it's the pandemic or supply chain or higher prices or lack of labor or global warming, like all of these features, they're letting them just try new things. And I think that's an awesome opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Grower and the Economist. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate it wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us get discovered by new listeners. If you have questions, concerns, or would like to suggest a podcast topic, please email me at michelle@strataderm.com. I love hearing from you. Until next time.